wouldn't make a difference. Hoping wasn't enough to get her son to his first college choice. A phone call the following Tuesday confirmed that the folder hadn't been postmarked in time, and Rob had automatically been placed at the end of the waiting list. As a small consolation, they assured her that the room deposit would be returned immediately. Her son didn't hold it against her. They spent a meal bitching about her supervisor at work, and then they began assembling acceptance materials for Rob's second choice, Yale University. Robert D. Peace, nickname Sean, F.O.D., Robert, Wideback. Activities, swimming 1, 2, 3, 4, water polo 2, 3, 4, math league 3, trail 1, 2, 3, honor code 4, overnight 2, 3, 4, senior group leader of DS 3, lacrosse 1. Favorites, Peace Family, CSP, Victor, De Burger Boys, Real People, and Knowledge. College future plans. Attend college, unknown, and accomplish many things. The yearbooks had been published before Charles Cawley made his offer, but Rob appreciated the fact that Yale wasn't listed on his page. He was embarrassed enough by the way his mother had been telling everyone she knew where he was going to school. She'd even submitted the information to the community page of the East Orange paper, bought many copies, and posted the small blurb on the bulletin board at work as a subliminal fuck you to her supervisor. "Ma, I'm going to get curbed," Rob said to her. She asked him what the term meant. He told her not to worry about the specifics, but to know that it wasn't something you wanted to have happen to you. She said, "I've been quiet about my son for 18 years. I can let people know you're going to college." "You don't have to advertise Yale, though," he replied. "People are already talking shit." "Let them talk. And watch your mouth. Anyone busy talking about you isn't going to Yale, I bet." But she saw how serious he was, and she stopped advertising to the extent that pride allowed her. Her mother, Frances, was sick with the early stages of emphysema. At graduation that spring, known as walking, Jackie sat in the back in case Frances needed to step away for a coughing fit. She listened to the valedictorian speak, less eloquently in her opinion than her son had spoken at the senior banquet. She watched her son walk in his broad-shouldered strut to receive his diploma. Afterward, milling in the crowd, she began to see familiar faces flitting in and out of view, estranged siblings, old neighbors, Skeet's friends and relatives. Boys Rob's age from the Orange High football team, people she hadn't spoken to or thought of in years. She needed a moment to realize that they were all there for her son, and another moment to understand that Rob, unbeknownst to her, had maintained relations with all these people, people she'd been too busy or tired to keep in touch with herself. He'd listed Peace Family first among his favorite things in the yearbook, and he'd made sure everyone he'd ever considered a part of that family was there that day, everyone except his father. The summer of 1998 was the last hurrah, and Rob and his friends treated it as such. Flowey, whose scholarship aspirations had been quickly doused along with any hope of affording college, he did not even apply, took a few weeks off before a coach at St. Benedict's helped him secure summer work as a lifeguard for the Department of Parks and Recreation. Everyone else was going to college. Victor to Daniel Webster College, Tavares to the University of Georgia, Clarkson, Drew to Johnson C. Smith, a small university in North Carolina, Curtis to Morehouse. They took the bus downtown for nostalgic lunches at the Burger King by school. Rob got a tattoo, a sphinx on his right biceps. Victor had drawn the picture during a 4th of July cookout, and Rob was sufficiently taken by the image to have it inked permanently on his skin. They barbecued in Curtis's backyard, and when his mother wasn't home, they drank a lot and smoked more. They talked about a future in which each of them would congregate here again in the homes and blocks they knew, with 4 out of 5 of them holding college degrees. They would get jobs and then get better jobs. They would save money and buy property, and then make profits to buy better property. They would sleep with many women until each found the woman who suited him, and then they would marry and have families, and be true to those families. They would teach their sons to swim and send them to St. Benedict's, where Friar Leahy would lecture them about manhood at convocation each morning, and Coach Ridley would run them through 6,000-yard swims at practice each afternoon, 10,000 yards during holiday double sessions. They would be businessmen, landlords, leaders. They would take care of their parents and each other. They harbored little doubt that this future, this collective trajectory, would be earned and actualized. They felt that in light of all the struggles they had endured, nothing ahead of them would feel very hard at all. Only time lay between now and then. In August, as Rob was getting ready for one more Appalachian Trail hike with the underclassmen, Jackie gave him a piece of mail with a Wilmington, Delaware return address. The letter began, "Dear Robert, looks like we're going to be roommates," and briefly described a guy who was going to run hurdles on the Yale track team and major in English. He professed to be relatively clean, quiet, and excited about college, except for the quiet part. These were lies. In the letter, he suggested that they talk on the phone before leaving for New Haven, so that they might suss out who was bringing what to furnish the room. The letter was from me. A week or so later, I came home from my summer job at a preschool for mentally challenged kids where I help with sports like kickball and floor hockey. I was turning around for track practice in preparation for the Junior Olympic Championships in Seattle that year when my mom, in the kitchen, shouted that one of my roommates, Robert, had called. She was cooking dinner for six, meat, starch, vegetables, as she'd done most every evening of my life. Above the kitchen table, more than a dozen photos of me and my siblings playing sports were arranged in a sprawling shrine. My little brother was watching The Simpsons on TV in the next room. Later that evening, I called Rob back. Jackie answered the phone. "Hello? Hi, this is Jeff. Is Robert there?" "Jeff who?" Her voice was curt, I felt, and bordering on suspicious. "Jeff Hobbs. How do you know Sean?" "I think we're going to be roommates." She remained silent, as if needing more information to complete the explanation. "At Yale? Oh, yeah. You're the one that sent that letter." "Yes, Mrs. Peace. Let me get you on." While I waited, I heard adult voices in the background, three or four arguing about something. Then Rob muttered at whoever was there to keep it down before he picked up the phone. "Hello?" That he was black was basically the first thing I learned about Rob Peace, evident in the first syllable of the first word he spoke. His voice was deep, as if created by a stone friction far down in a subterranean larynx. His speech had a viscous cadence, heavy on O's and lacking in hard R's, and he had a particular way of not responding to sentences, of embedding long silences into our conversation that left me slightly uneasy. The Orange, New Jersey address meant little to me. My older sister's college roommate was from a nearby town, and she came from a wealthy Italian family. As far as I knew, all of northern New Jersey was affluent, siphoning fortunes out of Manhattan. I learned over the course of our conversation that Rob had gone to a prep school. He played a little water polo, and his favorite pastime was hiking the Appalachian Trail. Nothing, he said, shaded him as anything other than well-off and overeducated, a typical rarefied Yale applicant. And yet there was something serious behind his voice, contemplative and world-wise. I told him that my older siblings, my brother a Yale graduate 2 years earlier, my sister going into her senior year at Yale, had advised organizing beforehand who would bring what to the room to prevent overlap. Rob told me he had a TV and a side table. I said I could bring a stereo and a few lamps. Neither of us seemed interested in prolonging the conversation. An inherent awkwardness existed in talking to someone whose face you'd never seen and with whom you would be living in tight quarters for the next 9 months. Later, he finally said and hung up. A few weeks later, Rob spent a day making rounds to his friends' homes. He spent another day visiting his father in Essex County Jail, where Skeet was still waiting for the post-conviction relief hearings to begin. The first hearing wouldn't take place for another 11 months. Then Rob loaded up his grandparents' car, TV, one large canvas duffel bag of clothes, backpack full of books, one side table, while his mother sat on the porch keeping watch, as it was foolish to leave a packed vehicle unattended for even a moment. Rob embraced Francis and Horace. Then Jackie drove him the 90 miles to Yale. After more than 2 hours, they rounded a bend in the interstate, and New Haven, similar in scope and appearance to Newark, coalesced into view. They joined the slow stream of cars, packed with the material existences of more than 1,000 other freshmen like Rob, and then stopped-started along Temple Street between the centuries-old, alternately Gothic and Georgian buildings in which he would now live alongside the hundreds of already-arrived students now jaywalking around their car in flip-flops. They rode mostly in silence, both exhilarated by what this new commute signified and frightened of the pending moment, not far away now, in which they would have to say goodbye. Part 3. Class of O'Deuce. Chapter 6. I entered my new home, a quad on the fourth floor of Landman Wright Hall, with both of my parents trailing behind me. My dad carried a small table, my mom an armload of new sheets. Dad was in a lousy mood. The 4-hour drive from Delaware had been followed by a 30 minutes jockeying for a parking spot near the eastern gate of Old Campus, the gorgeous sprawling quad in which most Yale freshmen lived, and now he had to contend with the stairs. After listening to him swear and honk as if the hundreds of other packed cars had no right to be there, barging in upon Jackie and Rob was jolting. They were just sitting in the common room, almost submissively still, resigned even. For a moment, the harried commotion that accompanied 1,218-year-olds moving into a single building over a 4-hour time window ceased entirely, replaced by the feeling that we'd interrupted a moment whose gravity lay far beyond me. His single duffel bag had been tossed on the floor in the left-hand bedroom, and a small bunny-eared TV was lying on its side in the common room. Random handprints marked the film of dust coating the blank gray screen. Rob wore jeans and a T-shirt, and his close-cropped hair made his face look very young, which belied his deep voice as he shook my mother's hand first, officiously, and said, "Pleasure to meet you, Mrs. Hobbs." Then he shook my father's. "Chuck Hobbs," Dad said. He appreciated a firm handshake, and I could tell he approved of Rob's grip. I had no idea what weight might lie within that grip on Rob's part. My dad was handsome and fit, and when he wasn't trying to park a car, he was gracious and kind, whereas Rob's father was an inmate. Mine was a surgeon. Dad's primary advice to me in preparing for college was to take easy intro classes the first semester. "Christ," he said, "I took some philosophy course my first semester of college, thinking it'd expand my mind or something, and it just about killed me." To Jackie, Dad said, "How are you doing today, ma'am? Bad traffic?"
"Wasn't much," Jackie replied, a little glumly.
She had gray in her short hair, a slight underbite that gave her a miffed expression, and very little interest in engaging with the Hobbses, even as her eyes seemed to probe each of us. Rob nodded in my direction and said, "Sup." We performed a half-handshake, half-hand-slap gesture at the level of our waists. I put my bags on the floor, not sure whether etiquette called for me to move into the room Rob had already chosen or wait for our other two roommates. In the self-centered context of my arrival at college, I never thought to wonder where Rob's dad was. I was too eager to peek into the bedrooms and confirm that the rumors of their dimensions had been true. Everyone downstairs was comparing them to prison cells. With measurements of 7x12, they were actually larger than the 6x8 cells at Trenton State. My mom was heartened that my rooming situation would include some diversity, and she became overly chatty with Rob.
"Have you thought about what classes you're taking? So you play water polo?
I guess all these stairs will keep you boys in shape," Rob humored her politely. After a time, she occupied herself with measuring all the windows for curtains she was planning to make on her sewing machine and bring with her on Parents' Day in 2 months. My dad and I plowed through a half-dozen trips to the car for clothes, school supplies, lamps, and tables. Each time we entered the room, Rob and Jackie seemed to be in the same curious state of doing nothing, not even talking. When the transfer was finished, Dad and I were both sweaty and stiff, and he was eager to beat the traffic home. He shook my hand and made a quick exit so as to hide reluctant tears. My mother embraced me, letting her own tears flow, and left as well. Both parts of the ritual I had witnessed in this same dorm between them and my older siblings, and so understood well. We felt nostalgic and perhaps a bit gloomy. This moment was a milestone that represented aging for them and the removal of childhood cushions for me, but not traumatized. We all knew that life hadn't actually changed all that much. Once they were gone, I realized that Jackie was now sitting on the windowsill overlooking a stone courtyard. Below her, a herd of students milled around, introducing themselves with a breathy, manic energy, exchanging hometowns and entryway assignments. Some were dressed in a style akin to business casual. Others wore PJs. Almost all were white and cheery and well-heeled, some veterans of mass move-ins after 4 years at elite boarding schools. Music played from speakers facing outward from someone's window. Guns N' Roses, Sweet Child of Mine. Jackie had barely moved all afternoon and had yet to appear anything other than impassively observant, judgmental even, and I felt compelled to perform for her somehow, to show that her son would not be living with just another wealthy legacy kid, though I was both wealthy and a legacy. I offered to get her some water, to remove bags from a chair so that she could sit to make a pizza run. She declined each outreach,
Nah, I'm all right.
Rob, too, seemed to be studying our surroundings and the people newly inhabiting them. The subtle negotiations already taking place over bunk assignments, bathroom stations, and furniture arrangement, the wide-eyed marveling over the bedroom sizes. He must have been thinking about summer phase at St. Benedict's, his 140 classmates with their sleeping bags and the hive, tasked with memorizing one another's names by week's end. Our other two roommates arrived. Dan Murray was a white guy from Seattle, his father a doctor like mine. He wore preppy clothes and carried a plastic water bottle with him at all times. He spoke very fast and in a high voice, such that it was impossible to understand him at first. Ty Canty was black Asian, black father, Japanese mother, and he ran the 400-meter hurdles, my event. He hailed from San Jose, California, where his father was a NASA engineer. A nearly flawless physical specimen, with chest and arms chiseled like a Greek sculpture, Ty had me intimidated before I even set foot on the track that year. The reasoning behind our random rooming assignment was clear. Ty and I were together because we both ran track. Ty and Rob were together because they were both African-American, and Dan had been tacked on as a white suburban kid, like me, to fill out the quad. Ty and I ended up sharing one bedroom, because we figured we'd be waking up early for practice and track meets together. Dan and Rob took the other room. Unstated but thickly understood was the fact that the right thing to do was to mix our races. Rob and Ty both claimed the bottom bunks. Dan and I politely seated them. Dan had gone on their week-long foot trip, an Appalachian Trail hike for incoming freshmen. Ty had participated in PROP, an orientation retreat for minorities during which they'd stayed at a nearby camping ground and played games like Capture the Flag. They had both already made friends, had begun to construct social lives here in a way that Rob and I hadn't. They flitted in and out of the dorm while Rob and I mostly stayed put, neither of us ready to join the fracas outside. Rob had set himself up in the room silently but directedly, never asking for permission or guidance on where to put things. For decoration, he pinned two pictures to the wall. One was of him and his mother at his St. Benedict's graduation. The other was of him, Curtis, Tavris, Drew, and Floey standing over a smoky grill in the backyard of 34 Smith Street, making east side hand gestures, the right hand extended palm in, fingers splayed except for the overlapping middle and ring fingers to form a warped E. With their baggy jeans, ribbed undershirts, and skull caps, they looked like a gang. As I spent the late afternoon organizing my desk with tchotchkes and pictures of family, he walked his mother downstairs to her car. Their goodbye, which took place among the honking lines of expensive foreign cars still coming and going, must have lasted 45 minutes. The first week of college, in my recollection, was a collective celebration of freedom. By day, this took the form of endless ceremonial speeches, extracurricular bazaars, and focus groups on sexual education. By night, more than 1,000 18-year-olds, many of whom had never truly partied before, engaged in some serious binge drinking. The shared bathrooms began to exude a vomit stench onto the stairwell landings. We lined up outside entryways and frat houses, waiting for our rations of stale keg beer. We crowded into Yorkside Pizza and Rudy's Bar, hoping to not get carded, which we always were. It was as if all of these kids had spent so long working so hard to get here that the reaction to actually being here was to become idiots. The RA fixed a paper bin filled with hundreds of multicolored condoms to the bulletin board in each entryway. The bins were empty by the following morning, prompting a sign that read, "Only take if you are actually going to use them." Kids sectored off into giddy groups that seemed preordained. The Manhattanites, the Midwesterners, the Californians, the Northeastern boarding schoolers, the internationals. Already coursing through the freshman class was the confident recognition, fostered in no small part by the university, that we were the elite, and these 4 years would be our passageway to flourishing in whatever arena we chose, and in the midst of that passage, we were entitled to celebrate our status freely, often sloppily. Rob wasn't sloppy. When he was in the room, he methodically paged through his blue book, the 3-inch thick paperback of course listings, with an almost menacing seriousness. He spoke in mumbled monosyllables as we gradually furnished and decorated. "Huh, yeah, cool." Sometimes I would pass him in the courtyard, sitting on a bench or a stone pillar smoking cigarettes, usually alone. The Yale student body, much like St. Benedict's, was divided into groups within the group in what was called the residential college system. Though almost all freshmen lived on old campus, our social lives were tagged to one of 12 colleges situated around the university,
each with its own distinct architecture, dining hall, library, and master. A designated professor who lived in a home affixed to the dorm, there to provide guidance and oversight. We were in Pearson College, a Georgian building that wrapped around a grass courtyard on the northwest corner of campus. First time the 100 members of the Pearson class of 02 congregated together, we were on the slate patio outside the dining hall. Rob stood on the fringe wearing baggy jeans, Timberland boots, and a scully, a tight thin piece of black nylon fabric in the shape of a stingray, the wingtips of which he bound at the base of his cranium. He was smoking a cigarette, his back turned to us. The classmates who hadn't met him yet clearly figured him to be a dining hall worker or part of the maintenance staff. He did nothing to dispel this notion. In fact, he seemed to take pride in it. Like his mother, on move-in day, he harbored little interest in interacting with the rest of us. Though I'd made an effort to be friendly enough, I kept my distance in those moments. An uncle had advised me not to get too chummy with my roommates early on because it was easier to become better friends than to extricate yourself from someone you didn't like. In a way that at the time felt natural but perhaps a bit too deliberate, I thought having a black roommate was fortunate. Though my high school was demographically the opposite of Rob's, 90% white, I was a national caliber hurdler and had spent my summers traveling and rooming with mostly black runners at junior Olympic meets. As a result of many long, cramped van rides, I had a familiarity with popular hip-hop artists of the day. I was conversant in certain strands of street lingo. That's tight, and I knew how to play spades. Overall, I considered myself quite the honorary black man, a title with which my old teammates had laughingly graced me. In the dining hall, I would seek out Rob and sit with him. To the extent that I could, I tried to subtly intimate how well qualified I was to be his pal, dropping small hints as to my comfort level among urban black males, omitting or outright lying about certain details that might undermine the claim. I told him I'd grown up near Philly, when in fact I had grown up in an 18th-century farmhouse on 15 acres of rolling rural hills in Chester County, 30 miles from the city. I consciously failed to mention that I had attended private school beginning in pre-kindergarten, and that my parents, who had been married for almost 30 years, had invested their entire lives, not to mention their finances, into taking care of their four children, removing all uncertainty from our formative years. The two Labradors, the trips to Florida each spring, the sports camps, the annual late summer mall trips for new school clothes, the pool behind our house, none of these flourishes of my life seemed to come up. Whether out of sensitivity or amusement, Rob never clued me into the fact that despite a few track meets, we hailed from different worlds, different families, different perspectives, different everything. I would learn that on my own over the course of many months, and never at my friend's behest. In the beginning, we were able to laugh over the fact that I was a white guy who ran sprints and he was a black guy who played water polo. Our friendship coalesced slowly, very slowly, from there. "What's your dad do?" I asked once during those first days. He finished chewing and swallowing his food. Rob filled his tray with massive heaps of sustenance, heavy on protein, and he lowered his face very close to the plate while eating, such that he was always looking up from beneath his fierce brow before replying, "He's in jail." "Oh," I said, "oh, sorry, I didn't." He shrugged and glanced away. "It's all good," he said, and then unprompted, "manslaughter." I asked nothing further. As he'd done in high school, he kept to himself the fact that the state of New Jersey's counterappeal to Robert Douglas's Sixth Amendment ruling began in earnest that October with another back-and-forth of motions to begin hearing arguments. The first hearing would not be held until the following March, and the process would stretch on into June, effectively encompassing Rob's entire freshman year of college. My older brother had spoken of it when he'd first left for Yale in 1992. How the black kids ate and hung out only with each other. How some kind of racism or reverse racism coursed through their social dynamic. 12 years old at the time, I nodded energetically at his keen cultural observation, wondering what it would be like to live out there in the real world. Yale at the time, seeming to me as such. 6 years later, my white classmates and I noticed pretty much the same thing. Yale intentionally fills its dining halls with long, narrow tables intended to spur discussions with new people during mealtimes. But once two black classmates sat down at the end of the table and were joined by three more and four more after that, from a distance their conversations tended to be loud, a little profane, punctuated with ticks of diction and dialect, not our own. These groups seemed to cordon themselves off from the majority, and if a white kid ventured to sit there, he looked conspicuously progressive, performing for the rest of the dining hall as if to say, "Look at me, I'm sitting with the black kid, so I am definitely not racist." This self-segregation and the self-consciousness it engendered in the white kids was most evident at lunch and dinner, but it extended to classrooms, libraries, and particularly weekend parties. Though rarely spoken of, certainly not by whites, the dynamic remained a quietly understood aspect of this strange new milieu in which we lived. In college, we were asked to become part of, and most of our parents paid small fortunes for us to become a part of, a manufactured civilization. A city within a city that trumpeted a long list of lofty ideals inscribed in Latin on the stone archways. As freshmen, we wanted to take ownership of our new place within this structure, to begin leaving our mark as the class of 2002. At the same time, we emulated the upperclassmen and their established social pretexts, begotten from the upperclassmen before them, and we succumbed easily to pressure. Academic, of course, but social even more so. White students went to frat houses, one of five popular bars, outdoor quad parties. Black students did something else, of which we knew little except that rap music was most likely playing very loud. The beginning of our first semester entailed much desperate scrambling. We scrambled to choose our classes, most with at least vague notions of future majors. We scrambled to find extracurricular groups to be a part of, sketch comedy troupes, film societies, social activist committees, etc. We scrambled for friends and social lives that, though we weren't necessarily aware of it then, would define us for the next 4 years. We were inclined to engage with cultural presentations like drama school plays, guest lectures, and singing groups to immerse ourselves in the Yale experience, colorfully advertised in our orientation materials. These inclinations would fade quickly, as all we really wanted to do was get decent grades and find free drinks. "Thursday is the new Friday," was a de rigueur expression. We sought out the adventures that we all assumed would form the basis for conversations at our 10th reunion in 14 years. "Didn't we once? Remember that time when we..." Above all, we did our best to define, and in most cases redefine ourselves. Jocks, intellectuals, humorists, student leaders, partiers, stoners, debaters, an electric feeling manifested that here, now, any one of us could be any person he wanted to be. No one knew what anyone else had been like in high school, and during the fall of 1998, we walked to classes and to parties and to meals on a blank slate. These first weeks were an ephemeral, transitional time, a collision of nervousness and self-consciousness and ambition and independence and confusion and bravado that sparked a collective blossoming and, in some cases, wilting of 1,200 teenage identities. I had no awareness of this then, of course I didn't, even though I lived with two black men and spent 4 hours every afternoon training with my racially mixed track teammates. But a deeper transition affected people of color in this dazed context. Before course selections and extracurricular sign-up sheets, before bags could even be unpacked in rooms, black students had to situate themselves within their own race. The process was complicated, conflicting, usually silent, highly fraught, and wholly invisible to their white classmates, most of whom had never actively had to consider the role of race in their lives, most of whom tended to see black culture as monolithic. Hence the black tables in the dining halls, viewed by the people sitting there as a filial group of like backgrounds and interests, West Coast or Caribbean Islands or Brooklyn, say, but viewed by those watching from afar as inherently exclusive. Others were seen as acting white when they sought out the majority-centric opportunities, an expansive humanities curriculum, a cappella groups, or as in Rob Peace's case, the water polo team. A latent variance also existed within the demographic among black students of affluent backgrounds, lower class, and all the gradations in between. Rob, being both black and poor, was in the minority of the minority. Of our class, 12% were black. Of that subset, 20% had grown up at or below the poverty line, about 30 classmates who could relate directly to where Rob had come from. And since he'd come from a city where he had been in every way a member of the majority, the transition was unsettling, and it must have inspired some level of resentment. However, Rob was incredibly skilled at not showing how he felt. He was also skilled at concealing who he was and who he wanted to be. In high school, he had been all things, an athlete, a leader, an academic, a partier. In college, he went about his days so very quietly, slipping in and out of the room with a head nod and a sup, his canvas book bag slung over his shoulder. The same book bag his father had bought him for Oakdale, scuffed and threadbare, which he'd taken everywhere in the neighborhood to Newark-proof himself. At meals, he usually sat alone near the entrance at a small round table just behind the station, where Jacinta Johnson, one of the dining hall ladies, swiped her ID cards. Jacinta was an overweight, light-skinned, red-haired African-American woman in her 40s, who had a grandmotherly aspect. Rob usually kept a textbook open in front of him, but he talked to her over his shoulder, and he made her laugh a lot. When I sat with him sometimes, his reserved demeanor in the open textbook elicited the question, "Is it cool if I sit here?" as if I might be intruding on intensive study or simply a desire to be alone, which was a desire that I myself valued highly, as solitude could be hard to find in college. He would shrug and say sure, and his dialogue with Jacinta would continue as he paged through the textbook and I opened a paperback from a Shakespeare's Tragedies or Romantic Poetry class, King Lear or Wordsworth. During that time, I didn't know him well, but I appreciated the quietude that surrounded him. Any other table in the dining hall carried the threat of having to perform for new acquaintances, to prove how clever or worldly or socially connected you were in the context of conversations about foreign policy, Ptolemy, the best bars on campus. With Rob, there was no judging, no need to hone any aspects of personality or tout knowledge. I could just sit, read, maybe joke about a roommate, Ty's weird sleeping hours, and weirder culinary routines. He would eat half a dozen microwave soy burgers at midnight, run 5 miles, and then go to the library until 7. An added benefit came with knowing that no one else would venture to sit with us, both because Rob always chose the smallest table and because our classmates still kept their distance. I hailed from a small school in a small town, and the social onslaught had been intimidating. Rob provided a buffer of which I, selfishly and without truly asking if I was welcome, took advantage. Then he met Zena. I wasn't privy to their brief courtship or really to any part of Rob's social life. From my perspective, one day our dorm room was what any dorm room shared by 4 18-year-old males was, a shambles of clashing furniture and clothes and books, but habitable and generally peaceful. The next day, the girl was camped out on our futon, which she'd folded out into bed mode, such that it took up half the common room, along with half her possessions. And she was not just any girl. Everything about her, her towering bun of coiled hair, her skirts that ballooned around her sprawled legs, her various moisturizers and conditioners, her high and ceaseless voice consumed space and oxygen. She was a senior from Jamaica, and though she had an off-campus apartment, she took up residence on the 4th floor of Landman Wright Hall, such that she seemed to be there at all hours, even when Rob was not. I observed from this too close vantage point, as over a span of less than a month, they succumbed to the dating tendency common among college students. They behaved as though they were married. I'd already observed this among others in our class, with college just weeks old. A few couples had formed who ate breakfast together in their sweatpants while reading the Yale Daily News, clasped hands while walking across the quad between classes, held court during dinner as if this were their home and they were hosting a society party, studied in adjacent library cubicles, and planned their weekends solely around each other. I could easily see why this happened. We were on our own for the first time, and people wanted to feel like legitimate adults. And then, in almost every case, the inevitable parting happened, impelled by the realization that they were not, in fact, adults, that codependence actually impinged on these precious 4 years of freedom. For those on the outside looking in, the subsequent breakup always presented good fodder for speculation. As the newness of college began to wane that semester, so did the compulsion to discuss serious topics, replaced by that old, reliable gossip. Rob and Zena were different, carrying something more consequential in their dynamic that precluded gossip and left one only to watch, often bewildered. They fought all the time. As in a marriage, their fights began with little things, our messy room, him not calling when he said he would, etc., that escalated into big things. Suspicions of cheating, he being fundamentally an asshole, she being fundamentally a bitch, etc. Because Zena had neither pitch control nor self-awareness about being overheard. Dan and Ty and I were privy to these fights with an intimacy none of us desired. I soon began to study in the library. They sounded scripted, like the domestic arguments policemen overhear in TV procedurals before they burst into a project housing drug den.
"Robert, you just smoke and eat your face off and don't do nothing," she yelled at him.
She was in her spot in the common room. He was in his bedroom with the door closed between them.
"Shut up, I'm trying to read."
"You're not reading. You're just sitting there all fucked up in your pigsty room."
Rob said what I, overhearing from my top bunk, had been wanting to say for quite some time. Zena nagged me about the mess, too.
"You think the room's too messy? Get the fuck out and go back to your own room."
And so on. I asked him once, with carefully premeditated phrasing, "What do you and Zena do for fun? Meaning, why are you with this woman?" In response, he showed me a leather jacket he'd been wearing lately, real leather, and the only possession of his that he seemed to take good care of, always folded and hung. I hadn't realized that it had been a gift from Zena. He said, "She's a real woman, not like these other Yaley bitches." Then he laughed and brought out the Facebook. This was before Facebook.com. The Facebook was a paperback room listing of the entire freshman class with headshots that boys spent hours combing through with highlighters to note those they would like to sleep with, realistically or not. Rob had marked a handful of pictures, not for himself, but for me. The freshman screw dance was coming up that weekend in which one's roommates arranged your date for the night. "Which one you into?" he asked. I looked over his listings and happily saw that he'd taken the task seriously, and the girls he had in mind for me were by and large attractive. After I ranked them, we huddled over the book together for the benefit of our other two roommates. Rob had it in his mind to screw Ty by setting him up with a less than desirable face. Rob and Ty got along well. They were both taking intro biology together, the precursor to pre-med classes. Like Rob, like almost all the students now surrounding us, Ty was a fantastic student, accustomed to straight A's in high school. Unlike Rob, he was tremendously competitive and pulled all-nighters with a particular pride, intent on being at the top of the class. Rob, who was laid back about schoolwork, had no problem with Ty's academic approach. Rob's problem had to do with the thug persona that Ty nurtured with near equal intensity. He wore a heavy jacket, with FUBU, an acronym of For Us, By Us, alluding to black people, printed in huge red letters across the chest, and he came to be referred to as T-Money, or as he signed off on his emails, T$. He talked hard and seemed to loop every other story about high school around to some fight he'd been in, some girl he'd slept with, some bad neighborhood he'd hung out in. Ty had grown up in the suburbs and spent money freely. He bought new clothes frequently, to the point that they burst out of our shared closet and onto every hangable ledge, including the FUBU jacket, which Rob told me cost upward of $300, noting that the For Us part of the slogan did not apply to poor black people. And he ate a lot of takeout food from the overpriced delis on Elm Street because the dining hall food, already paid for in his tuition, roughly $25 a day, was unappealing. He considered himself quite the ladies' man, kept his shirts ironed, and his Tommy Hilfiger cologne stocked. Obsessed with his physique, his desk was rowed with industrial-size containers of GNC products like creatine and whey protein powder. He sometimes lifted weights in the Pearson gym at 3 a.m. He was friendly and funny, but he was all but incapable of daily chores like laundry, bathing, disposing of half-eaten soy burgers. Squirrels began sneaking into our common room for leftovers. Rob, who had been responsible for his own household since 1987, didn't like it. So when Ty was pounding his chest about someone who'd punked him and who had a beatdown coming his way, Rob just laughed and said, "T, we both know you ain't gonna do shit, so quit frontin'." The word fronting was important to Rob. A coward who acted tough was fronting. A nerd who acted dumb was fronting. A rich kid who acted poor was fronting. Rob found the instinct very offensive, and in college he saw it all around. He felt as though people were in a constant state of role play before teachers, before each other, even before Jacinta in the dining hall. Some students would pass her briskly as if in training for futures filled with ignorable service workers, while others would stop and chat with perky but manufactured curiosity. When he spoke contemptuously of this, about midway through that fall, I was surprised. For the last 2 months, because of how he carried himself, I'd figured him to have nothing more than marginal interest in all but a few of his peers. I learned that he tracked the people surrounding him with the observational intensity of the novelist I aspired to be. And he was not above judging them, often harshly. "It's like nobody's real here," he said to Zena late one night. Ty was at the library. I was in bed with the door closed. Rob and Zena were in the common room, curled together beneath a blanket. It's like you can't have a real conversation with anyone. You're real, baby, she told him and made a cooing sound as the sheets rustled and the futon creaked. You too, he replied. I didn't overhear any more because I'd buried my head under the pillow in the event of imminent lovemaking. But I thought about those words often, along with other more oblique references to what he saw as a fundamental flaw in the social construct we now inhabited. I didn't know then the degree to which surviving his childhood had necessitated his own brand of fronting, the many different masks he wore on Chapman Street, at St. Benedict's, in East Orange. I didn't know about the Newark proofing he had mastered. I'm certain that if presented with this question, he would have argued very precisely that what he did growing up, what he still did when he went home, had not been fronting at all. He would have argued, and I would have believed, that his various manifestations of self represented the height of authenticity, that he was each of those people. I'm not fronting, he might have said. I'm just complicated. Parents' weekend came a few weeks before Thanksgiving. As we scrambled to clean our room and fabricate the impression that we were in fact self-sufficient and responsible adults, Rob stowed a few books and clothes into his backpack. You making a break for Zena's place? I asked. No, Newark, he replied. He pronounced the city name very fast and with no accented syllables. Newark. I'd grown up near Newark, Delaware, which we called Newark in our hybrid tri-state dialect, a tic that Rob considered a sacrilege. Newark, 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 he'd spent the fall drilling me. Say it three times fast. Try not to sound like such a honky. Your mom isn't interested in the big football game? I asked, jokingly. She has to work all weekend, he replied, not joking. In a kind of reverse commute, as thousands of parents descended on the campus, he took the metro north-southwest along the string of Connecticut commuter towns, through the Bronx and into Manhattan's Grand Central. Then the subway shuttled him to Penn Station, where he boarded the PATH train to Newark, and Flowey picked him up. The transit took about 2.5 hours, and he would make it dozens of times over the next 4 years. They smoked marijuana at Flowey's apartment for a bit. Flowey had performed well enough lifeguarding that the job was secure for the following summer. Between seasons, he was working for a landscaper blowing leaves. He'd rented an apartment with his girlfriend, Laquisha, on a marginally safer street a couple of blocks from where he'd grown up near Valesburg Park. The building was filled with loud neighbors and hallways that were busier at 2 a.m. than 2 p.m., but on the fifth floor, he had a nice view east toward downtown. From above, East Orange looked quite peaceful, particularly on autumnal evenings like this one. He asked Rob how school was going, and Rob rolled his eyes. You know, he said. How the hell do I know? Flowey laughed. I don't go to no Yale U. The work isn't much harder than St. Benedict's, but the people... And he paused to make one of his fsha sounds. The people are hard to take. Sometimes I just have to check out. How do you have time to check out at a school like that? That's the thing, Rob said. At St. B's, we had no time. Between work, lifeguarding, school, practice, film, homework, home shit, any spare time we had just used it to sleep, remember? True. I remember sleeping on stairs, sleeping on the bus, sleeping on the benches by the pool. Exactly. But in college, you don't have but 3, sometimes even 2 hours of classes a day. Food's cooked for you, all the food you want. And boy, I kill those buffets. Rent's paid for, utilities too, no family around to see. You can only study so much. Rob would get straight A's in a schedule that included advanced calculus, 200-level physics, and a religious studies class in Buddhism. And the rest of the time is just that, time. I've never had that before. So, you know, I'll go to my boy's house, smoke out a bit, just chill. They talked about their families and friends for a while. How Curtis, by all accounts, was the king of campus at Morehouse, but Tavris and Drew were both struggling academically, and in Tavris's case, financially. Tavris had spent months assembling a package of loans to pay for college, and now was looking at the interest rates and decades-long payment plan, and wondering how a college education could possibly be worth it. How are you making it work? Rob asked Flowey. Food, rent, all that? Hustling on the side a little bit, Flowey said. You know. You got a good connect? Rob asked. A connect was a bulk supplier who provided marijuana to small-time dealers like Flowey, selling it to them for less than they could sell it for, but assuming less risk.
He's cool?
Yeah, he's good people. And then Flowey thought of something.
People must smoke up at Yale, right?
Hell yeah, Rob said.
Could be an opportunity.
Rob began thinking as well. Flowey offered to drive him to Chapman Street, 2 miles away. Rob opted to walk. Dusk had fallen, and Flowey watched from the window as his friend trudged off slowly through the hood. He was wearing the leather jacket that Xena had given him, and Flowey thought that was a mistake, something the young punk dealers making the first cash of their lives would do to flaunt it. Others would see the leather and think he had money on him. He wondered if Rob had grown so accustomed to his new surroundings, the poshness and security that Flowey imagined often while triangulating heaps of leaves in front of high-rise apartment buildings, that he'd lost that acute awareness of the details necessary to stay safe. But he didn't say anything. Rob, more than most, could take care of himself. Yesterday, Rob had walked about the same distance, from our room to Science Hill for biology class, past Sterling Memorial Library and its 4 million books, across the marble stones of Binicky Plaza, with its sculpted memorials paying tribute to Yale students lost in both world wars, beneath the 40-foot golden dome of Woolsey Hall, past the university president's mansion on Hill House Avenue toward the modernist 20-story building around which were clustered 11 different science labs, each of them larger than St. Benedict's. Today, he walked through the network of dealers who governed Valesburg Park, along Central Avenue a few blocks from where the Moore sisters had been killed, and then to Chapman Street. Along the way, he passed small houses, tall project towers, struggling businesses gating their doors, and poor people going wherever they were going, heads angled down, and with every step some sector of his consciousness must have wondered how he'd gone from this world to that, why he'd gone, for what larger purpose. He was stoned, and perhaps this softened the impact of his feet, the impact of these questions. And maybe it also stoked the idea that there was money to be made at Yale, which would carry none of the hazards that it carried on the streets he was walking. He made it home without incident and watched TV with his grandparents until Jackie got off work at 11. The two of them ate dinner together at midnight, pork chops that Rob had bought on the way home and cooked with rice. He knew that she'd cried for the first 2 months he'd been away. He'd spoken to her on the phone nearly every night, short murmured conversations that he took into his bedroom with the door closed. I'd been affected by the way he said goodbye as he emerged. "All right, Ma, you're my heart," with an earnestness that belied his demeanor. This made me feel guilty for all the times I'd hurried off the phone with my own mother, still working on those curtains, asking for further window measurements, saying briskly, "Later, Mom." While the rest of us toured our parents around campus that weekend, energetic with pride as we key-carded our way through the gated archways, leading into catered buffets and ultimately congregating at the football field for the weekend's game, Rob sat on the porch and smoked cigarettes with Jackie before making the rounds of old friends. He stopped by St. Benedict's to have lunch with Friar Leahy and observe an off-season water polo shoot-around, giving in to the impulse to bark commands to players. His Ivy League association caused him to be treated by former classmates, kids he'd led on the Appalachian Trail, as a conquering hero. After that, he visited his father at Essex County and most likely got up to speed on the appeal situation. By that time in early November, Skeet was still standing by while Carl Herman submitted the long succession of preliminary documents, many of them recycled from the successful PCR hearing. They were accustomed to the administrative lag times by now, but the waits carried a more expansive kind of anxiety than either of them had before known. In Skeet's and Rob's eyes, the man had been freed, his conviction overturned on no less an authority than the Constitution of the United States, and yet here they were again, battling the legal army of a state-sponsored apparatus that seemed intensely focused on keeping him imprisoned. My own father had been sending me letters which arrived in my post office box each Thursday. He'd made this effort for my two older siblings during their first semesters at Yale. Dad was not the most emotive man, and he wrote these messages on small yellow post-its, a few illegible sentences along the lines of, "Hope your classes aren't too bad and practice is going well. Grandma came over for dinner on Sunday. Mom made lasagna. Hang in there, Dad." Attached by a paperclip would be a small news article from the local paper about my high school football team. As the weeks went on, the meaning of these letters evolved from nostalgic to something more powerful. They became the primary, tangible reminder that home still existed. While I moved through the trials and tribulations of this much-hyped college experience, the inconsistent loops and falls of my dad's handwriting still took minutes per word to decipher, and my mom still made lasagna when Grandma came over. The world might be big and layered, but my life within it was small, secure, rooted in old simplicity. Marijuana, I believe, served the same function for Rob, a bridge spanning far more distance than my own, between the world he'd come from and the world he found himself in. I had no idea how much he smoked, and just like he had in his mother's house, he hid it well. He smelled more thickly of chlorine from water polo practice, the initiation from which had found him wearing a toga in the middle of the Commons dining hall singing "Express Yourself" by Madonna, than he ever did of weed. He never smoked in the room. Scents could not cling to his leather jacket. He seemed zoned out fairly often, crouched over a textbook with the TV on and music playing loud, but I just figured that was a quirk. In order to focus, he needed to create an excess of noise to shut out. Track practice was year-round, so Ty and I were catching the 3 o'clock shuttle bus out to the athletic complex, a mile from campus, where we spent the fall running endless wind sprints across a grass intramural field known as the Flats that stretched a quarter mile toward a hillside of fiery autumnal leaves. We trained for 2 hours and then took the bus back to the campus gymnasium to lift weights for another hour, then had dinner before returning to the dorm around 7 to work. These were 4 hours every day during which we were completely checked out from the campus, loosening our bodies from our minds, and 4 hours that I later learned Rob spent getting high with a new group of friends who lived off campus, doing pretty much the same thing. People called it the Weed Shack, a two-story clapboard house on Temple Street, 2 blocks west of campus proper. Sherman Feerick, a junior, was the leaseholder, and 4 or 5 others lived there with him. Sherman had grown up in Montclair and been a football star. He was an intelligent talker, and he talked nonstop. When he'd first met Rob, he'd said, "So you're the new one," meaning the single token poor African-American male Newarker admitted to Yale each year. The two men were drawn to one another the way Newarkers living outside Newark tended to be. Their shared knowledge of the very particular milieu made for a strong bond, and so did the fact that Sherman consumed and sold weed. After his conversation with Flowey about possibly selling on campus, Rob ran the idea past Sherman, out of respect more than a desire to have questions answered. Rob told him that Charles Cawley sent the tuition checks directly to the school, but that didn't account for books and lab equipment, which approached the level of his entire high school tuition. He told him that his mom was in bad shape, tired, poor, and now alone. He shrugged casually and said he could use a little money. And Sherman, rather than feel like his own earnings were threatened, began steering a little business Rob's way, just like Rob had done for Tavris in high school. He schooled him on how to stay under the university's radar, which was practically effortless as long as you weren't stupid. Rob became a fixture in the Weed Shack's living room, where a bong or a joint was perennially lit and shared by whoever happened to be hanging there. Those sunken couches and scavenged chairs provided a safe haven for students to get stoned and say what they really felt about Yale, about Yaleys, about the Yale experience. Their criticisms could get acidic, coalescing into a kind of groupthink that, for Sherman at least, looking back years later, went far beyond what the actual reality merited. That a Yale education was a rare and coveted gift remained always a part of the big picture, but few things were easier for a group of young men to lose sight of than the big picture. Some of their grievances were common to the point of cliché. The school tailored itself towards rich kids, legacies, phonies. The financial aid packages were basically for good PR and entailed more paperwork than any 300-level class. The social hierarchy in place was more vapid than high school. The professors outsourced the actual teaching to TAs a few years older than the undergrads, while they focused on their own research. Other complaints were more nuanced, invoking deeper historical elements of the minority condition. PROP, the Minority Orientation Week that Rob had not attended, had included seminars on how to take notes. "Like we need to learn how to hold a pencil," Sherman said. The AFAM house was hidden on a small footpath on the edge of campus, tucked away behind the Art and Architecture Building on York Street, smaller and more remote than the cultural centers for Asians, Hispanics, Jews. The university proper refused to give any official sponsorship to the annual AFAM Week, in which black students from all over New England came to campus for a long weekend of lectures and parties. This place, they collectively opined, was racist. Rob, by all accounts, had never thought much about race. While he had painstakingly devised methods to navigate the different groups of people in his life, almost all of those people had been black. Uncharacteristically for the average black student coming to Yale, he'd never contemplated, let alone practiced, the fine intricacies of living in a socioeconomic atmosphere not his own. New friendships with people who railed against those intricacies loudly, profanely, had him thinking about race very much. Typical of Rob Peace, though not of Sherman and the others, he did so intellectually, rather than angrily. "Say a white boy takes a wrong turn and comes to my hood," he once said. "Now he's in the minority. Nobody wants him there unless it's to rob his ass, and more than anything, he has to think about how to protect himself, how to get out. There's no weaker situation to be in than that, and this boy isn't getting anything productive done until he's out, back among his own people. But we take a wrong turn and end up at Yale. For the first time in our lives, we don't have to worry about protecting ourselves. And we were all able to get enough shit done to be accepted here. So imagine what we can do when you take all the crazy hood shit out of the equation and we can just focus on the business at hand. So what if it's annoying as hell? Instead of sitting around here bitching about it, maybe we just accept that it is what it is and know that we have the capacity to get way more from them than they'll ever get from us." He took a mighty pull from the bong and sat back, eyes closed, exhaling a hypnotic plume of smoke into the air above him. A week-long Thanksgiving vacation was coming, which he would spend in reunion with the Burger Boys. He would also meet Floey's Connect, so that he could bring back a few ounces of weed to sell in eighths to his classmates during the harried weeks preceding final exams. This he would do quietly, away from his own living space, and invisibly to his roommates. Chapter 7. A winter evening at Yale could have a spectral quality. The untouched snow in the center of the Pearson College quad tamped the urban noise while brightening the halos cast by half a dozen gas lamps. On the bells of Harkness Tower, the Guild of Carillonneurs played the 1812 Overture. The students had, for the most part, retreated to their rooms, and each of the few hundred windows embedded in the brick facade emitted a warm light, suggesting comfort, focus, and industry within. As I walked the 30 yards between the dining hall and entryway D, still faint from a track practice that had left me dry-heaving beneath the bleachers in Cock's Cage, it was easy to forget that we weren't actually existing in the New England of colonial times, when these structures had in fact been built. Our sophomore dorm room was less tranquil, looking as though a bomb composed of dirty laundry, CDs, and aluminum takeout food containers had detonated. I flicked on the lights, and Rob materialized out of the dark. He'd been sitting in a wooden chair in the far corner, head bowed, one hand hanging over his broad chest, while the other picked at his frayed, newly grown cornrows. The room was thickly perfumed with incense. In a charged flurry one night a few weeks earlier, he'd written some of our favorite verses in permanent black marker on the white walls. One of my contributions had been the last line of Tennyson's poem Ulysses, "To strive, to seek, to find, and not to yield." Above it, Rob had written a stanza from a ludicrous song that detailed having sex with a woman on the 50-yard line of the Georgia Dome. Rob sat just beneath those lines, his exhalations audible and weighty. His dining hall uniform was unbuttoned over a ribbed, sleeveless undershirt. His face was angled down in a way, but his body resembled a dark, clenched fist. The second half of freshman year had passed uneventfully. We'd cemented our friend groups, grown accustomed to the academic cycle, and in some ways come to see this place as our home. Rob and Zena had broken up, and my initial urge to celebrate had been tempered by how truly depressed Rob had become in the weeks after. He'd begun working in the Pearson dining hall for $8 an hour in the spring of freshman year, starting in the dish room, same as Jackie. And when I came to eat, he would take a break to sit with me behind Jacinta until she told him, smilingly, to get his ass back to work. While I had gone home for the summer to the same job I'd had in high school, Rob had remained in New Haven for the first half to work on the custodial staff during Yale's reunion weekends, and then he'd spent the second half at home with Jackie and his friends. In June, Skeet's post-conviction relief had been over